Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right, guys. Welcome to the Full Blast Podcast. Pat Quinn's back with Great Question with Pat Quinn. Before we get into it, I have to take care of a little business. I want to thank my sponsors. Number one, I want to thank Broadbeck Ironworks, makers of the 2x72 grinder. This is a dynamite grinder, and it's one of those grinders that makes your life a lot easier. So if you go to broadbeckironworks.com, you can see what they have. They have different options. It's very versatile. It goes, you know, horizontal. It goes vertically. They have different attachments. And if you go to broadbeckironworks.com, you can use a promo code. The promo code is KnifeTalk10, and you'll get 10% off the grinders, attachments, parts, all that stuff. So definitely think about it. It's a great company. They're a great American company making really good products for anybody, not just knife makers, metal workers, sculptors, woodworkers. You're removing material. Broadbecks are great for you. So go to broadbeckironworks.com, put in the promo code KnifeTalk10 for 10% off. I want to thank my friends at Even Heat. Even Heat Kilns. You can't get much better than Even Heat. Even Heat is Full Blast is sponsored by Even Heat. That's it. I mean, they're sponsored, but they're sponsored by this podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Even Heat. They're the manufacturers of the finest heat treat ovens available. So go to evenheat-kiln.com and check out what they have. If you're doing any type of knife making, you're making tools that need to be hardened, are you doing ceramics or glass blower, you need something where you have a very specific temperature and you need to hold it there, this is the one for you. If you're trying to get into stainless steel, you're trying to get into Damascus, you're trying to get into that stuff where it's very specific temperatures, get it right. Do it right. Go get yourself an Even Heat and stop playing, because that's enough for you. I want to thank my friends at Maritime Knife Supply. Oh, boy. They are the one-stop shop for all your knife-making needs, belts, abrasives, steels, kilns, forges, presses, heat treating ovens, all that stuff. And on top of that, I just want to, this is going to be very forging heavy episode, but Pat's comes on once a month and we want to talk about forging. I got some of, Lawrence Lake has a pile of different size hex bars at a 1080, and I forged an integral bolster, integral chef knife with it. And I want to just talk about it on the podcast, but he's got a stock size. He's got stock sizes that are not easy to get a hold of, and they're very easy to ship, and he ships them in 4-foot sections. The prices are great. The steel is very easy to work with. It's not a size of steel that you can get everywhere or anywhere. So definitely go check out Maritime Knife Supply and see what all the fuss is about. And one of the great things about what they're doing is Lawrence and Maritime Knife Supply are sponsoring the Great Lakes Custom Knife Show, and it's happening Saturday, August 17th in Ontario. It's Canada's largest knife show, and located off the shores of Lake Huron, featuring some of the best talents in Canadian knife making. Go to Great Lakes Custom Knife Show on Instagram or greatlakescustomknifeshow.com for more information. Noah Vachon is going to be there, and a lot of other really, really, really talented people. Some guys from, you know, there's going to be some guys from Michigan too, and some guys from the United States, but it's going to be a great opportunity to meet some awesome Canadian knife makers, and it's a great show, and it's sponsored by Maritime Knife Supply, so it's good enough for you, it's good enough for me. And I want to thank Maritime Knife Supply. I swear to God, that 1080 hex bar was awesome, so definitely go get yourself some of that. And they got sizes that are, like, you know, not your average size, so, like, 10, you know, it was there was inch, there was inch and an eighth, there was all sorts of different great sizes for you'll making them integral knives. All right, next are my friends at Trojan Horse Forge at trojanhorseforge.com. Sam and Jeff have done it again with the Stable Rail knife finishing vise. The knife vise are built in the heart of Texas, and these things are sick. I have a couple, and it's not just for the handles. They have they have plates, and then you can hand sand your knife comfortably. Supports a distal taper. That integral chef knife we had, we were able to move the deck down, and we were able to support the bolster kind of fit in. We were able to adjust it so we could fit it in, and it was unbelievably great and comfortable. So definitely go get yourself one of them. TrojanHorseForge.com's Trojan Horse Forge Stable Rail knife finishing vices. And if you go to TrojanHorseForge.com, put in the promo code FULLBLAST10, and you get 10% off everything, the T-Force Sentinel Oil, the handle, press attachment, all that stuff. So definitely check it out. And, it comes in a bomb-proof case. There's all sorts of parts that they give you extras on. It's just a great company, and I'm really, really impressed with the performance of their vices. So definitely check them out. I want to thank my friends at Baker Forge and Tool. That's BakerForge.com, makers of exotic steels that are easy to work with, and they have a lot of bang for your buck. I just put together a chef knife. They sent me some of their, it's got Apex Ultra Core, which I'd never used before, and it has great cladding, lots of Damascus, and there's copper shims and all that stuff. And the cool thing is, you can get stuff that maybe you've never worked before, and then they have a whole heat treating section on their website, and it explains step by step what to do. So you're never in question. So it came out really awesome, and I used the Gator Piss to kind of make the etching and make the separation between the high carbon steel and the high nickel steel, and it's really great. So get yourself some of that Gator Piss, because I mean that stuff is where it's at, and I would highly suggest getting some of the steel. Every steel I've gotten from Baker Forge has been awesome and easy to work with. Use it on your bandsaw, no big deal. It's definitely works great, and the Gator Piss is, I mean, it just like, it's really great. It's really easy to work with and highly suggested. So not only can you get it at bakerforge.com, and if you put in the promo code FULLBLAST, you get 10% off, but you can get it at Texas Farrier Supply. My friends Evan and the guys over at Texas Farrier Supply are stocking Gator Piss, but not only Gator Piss. They have the Rhino Wet. They have all that stuff. It's a great company in Texas that serves the knife making and the farrier and the blacksmithing community. They have tongs. They have anvils. They have all the stuff you need if you're a farrier or if you're a blacksmith or your knife maker, all the supplies, all that stuff. It's a great place, and they're going to sell. They have Gator Piss, and you can use Knife Talk 10 for 10% off over at Texas Ferry Supply. So I want to thank my friends Evan and the guys over at Texas Ferry Supply. This stuff is awesome, and I'm a huge fan of Texas Ferry Supply. It's been great. I've been getting a Rhino Wet from them for a while. I want to thank my friends at Total Boat, totalboat.com/fullblast for all your adhesives, paints, primers, polishing compounds. I use strictly Total Boat for handle attachment. I've never once had a problem. Very impressed with it. They have all sorts of dyes. They have all the things that need you to, so you can be successful. And I would highly suggest checking it out. And also, if you want to get into the hybrid handle material game, you can get some of their Fathom 6 thick set, and stuff is dynamite. So go to totalboat.com/fullblast, and you will get, that is the link. And all the links are in the show notes of where you can find this podcast on the bottom. It'll have all the links, and it'll allow you to go direct and then use that link, and then you give me street cred. So Keith Johnson, Derek from Malden, Keith Mitchell, Jimmy Duress, so they're all using that Total Boat, and it's good enough for them, it's good enough for you, it's good enough for me, it's good enough for you. If it's good enough for me, it's good enough for you. I'm telling you, I've been using Total Boat for a long time. I've never had a problem with it. This stuff is tough, super tough, and I really like that stuff very much. So many thanks to my friends at Total Boat. I want to thank my friends at GL Hansen & Sons, at g.l.hansen&sons on Instagram. Go to gcarta.bigcartel.com to get your G-Carta. Well, now, what's G-Carta? G-Carta is a unique composite of natural fibers and fabrics mixed with epoxy under pressure. Stuff is awesome. You can totally 100% get the Bofa Ripple Cut by Tuxini. Get the Mikey's making the Mahi Mahi Radioworm G-Carta Pheasant Colorama Hoopla. Stuff is really awesome, and it's easy to work with, and there are beautiful patterns and colors that can get you squared away if you want a little razzle dazzle in your life. You know what I'm saying? Because here's the thing. Handles are handles, and it would be nice to be able to do something different and give yourself some pizzazz. And I'm finally starting to get customers reaching out to me about specific colors from specific patterns and colors from GL Hanson and Sons. I'm getting specific requests for like Hoopla and Colorama. So it's really great stuff, and you should get a hold of it, and you'll like it. So gcarter.bigcartel.com. Once again, all the links are in the show notes or wherever you're listening to this. And I want to thank my friends at Tormek, celebrating 50 years of being in business with the Black T8 sharpening system. This is a water-cooled sharpening system that will change the way you make knives. It's for sharpening. It just doesn't come any better. When I was back in the day, if you wanted to get something sharpened, you bring your knife to a hardware store, and they have just a bench grinder, and then and all of a sudden your knife looks like, you know, it looks like it's, and now all of a sudden your knife is a serrated knife. It's banged up, scratched up. The water cooled system spins at a very slow rate. The water's really, really, it keeps it cool, but it also keeps a slurry to help polish your blade. They have different grit progressions, and you have jigs. You don't have to use the jigs. They have a leather strop that works on the side. They have compound. Stuff is really great, and it's made me a better knife maker by far. So if you go to Tormek.com or Tormek_sharpening on Instagram, you can see what the fuss is about. In this August, I'm going to be going out to Sweden. I got Tormek invited me to do something. We're going to hang out with them. We're going to see the tour of the facility. We're going to, I was involved in a knife art show. We're going to go out there. I'm going to meet with those guys, and we're going to have them on. I wanted them to tell their story, and we're working out the details of how to best do it. But the guys at Tormek are awesome, and it's a great company. They've been in business for 50 years, and that's good enough for me. It should be good enough for you. And it's made me a better knife maker. Florentine Kitchen Knives uses them, and if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for all of you. Trust me. So definitely check out what's going on at Tormek.com, and check them out at Tormek_sharpening on Instagram. Now, I am very grateful that my friend Pat Quinn is back. Pat Quinn is the director of the Center for Metal Arts, and we are doing this great opportunity. This is a great opportunity for you to ask blacksmithing questions for Pat. Pat has been coming on once a month, and I've been really enjoying not only talking to him, but also being able to interact with the audience to have them ask questions. And Pat has they're really, you know, very nuanced answers that I think that you're not going to find very often. So without any further ado, my good friend Pat Quinn's back. Pat, how are you?
I'm doing great. Jeff, how are you doing?
I'm tired. I'm tired. Oh. I'm tired. And I'm tired because, I shouldn't complain. But a lot of traveling. I just got back from Spain last week, and I'm like kind of get my legs back to under me, and it was a lot of great time with doing some workshops. Mm-hmm. And I'm very excited about, you know, working. But I do have a story that I want to tell you after we kind of, you know, get into this a little bit. How have you been? And furthermore, you just are on I think you're on your last week of the Forging Focus class. How has it been going?
Good. You know, I thought tired was implied when you asked me how I was doing. That's why I didn't say it.
But yeah, tired is implied. Tired is implied.
No, it's going really good. This is quite literally the last day here. I had a really productive 4 weeks, hitting everybody with forging technique and, you know, forging to spec. And then Matt Jenkins from Cloverdale Forge is here, and they're really having a good time working on product design segment. And it's just a nice juxtaposition because I put them through mostly technical challenges and they don't get any creative release. And then Matt's all about creativity challenges and designing and building your own sort of product. So it's been a really fun 2 weeks, and they've enjoyed the transition into this. And like I've said before, Matt's just one of the best teachers out there and just such a great, great person to be around and a true inspiration.
Yeah, I've been chatting a little bit with him lately, and we're going to have him on sooner rather than later.
Oh, good.
I know he's got some projects coming up that we want to I want to get in when the projects are. We're going to get him squared away. But one of the interesting things about your classes, and I've talked to you in the past, is the most unique part is how kind of bonded you guys all get.
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely.
It's unique. I mean, it's unique just to education in general.
Yeah, there weren't any group tattoos this time around, but it's a good group, and that's part of the whole experience here is, you know, living with somebody for 6 weeks. You really have no choice but to bond and get to know one another really well, and you know, it's like they're right next to you for you know, 12 hours a day at the anvil and the power hammer, and then you go home and you have to eat dinner with them and, you know, share a living space. It's pretty intimate, and it's a really good way to meet folks and who are interested in the same stuff you are, working in the same medium, but also, you know, have differences, backgrounds and opinions and experience levels. So it's a really rich experience, I think, on more levels than just technically in the forge.
Can you elaborate on the richness of it? I mean, I know you back it up a little bit. I mean, it is, I remember you said last time I saw you, you said that one of the forging focuses, you guys all get group tattoos, which is like, that's unbelievable. What a commitment. I mean,
yeah,
that's unbelievable.
Well, but realistically, it's like, you know, these people, I think they become friends for life. And it just warms my heart to hear about how everybody stays in touch, you know, after the forging focus. And then it even sometimes leads to like employment opportunities. Like we had a student last year, Haley, and you've met Haley, and
sure.
And they went to, you know, work for Matt after the forging focus for some time. And it just is a real nice sort of like community development, networking, just really broadening your horizons, kind of a experience on more levels than just forging.
Is it possible that this also has to do with forging in general? Because I mean, it is like there's an incredible aspect of forging where it's the kind of, it's this manipulation of mass. And you're creating this permanence, and there's so much like it's there's so much humanity in the act of forging. Mm-hmm. I wonder, you do a 6 week math, you know? Oh no, let's not use math. Let's say you do a 6 week English class. Mm-hmm. Are people bonding? I'm not 100% so sure. So I wonder if it has to do with also the passion that you guys do over at CM, the passion that you guys emit at CMA, but also like the forging is one of those like lifelong journey experiences. And I wonder if part of that's, it's the whole package.
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of forging is like, especially if you're an artist, it's incredibly personal to you. And, you know, specifically with these 2 weeks with Matt, but I think it can happen with any art or craft, but CMA, it just seems to happen here. But when you're working all day and then you're forced to like sit down in a group setting with your peers and colleagues and talk about the work that you've created, especially if it relates to you personally on some level, which most of the time it does, that's a pretty vulnerable place to be. And when you're vulnerable and open, there's no other option than to bond, I feel like.
Well, I mean, it is amazing. And I would imagine that it also, when you put up a course that's 6 weeks long, you also are getting somebody who is committed. I mean, it isn't a weekend class or a day class or even like a few day classes. That's just like, okay, let's dip my toe in this situation. If you're doing like 6 weeks, you've already committed to that situation.
Yeah, definitely. There, you know, and that's sort of that long-term programming stuff that we always talk about, the direction that CMA is heading in is, you know, it's really attractive for people who want to make a career out of it. But, you know, my philosophy has always been like a proper education or, you know, formal educational institution over sort of like just having a craft experience kind of a thing. And so, you know, this program in particular, I think, really represents that sort of mindset and philosophy.
So what's next? I mean, this is the last day of the forging focus. What's the next step for you? Where are you going now?
I'm juggling a bunch of stuff, which is cool, but there's, you know, I think there's a few too many this year. I'm managing, but it definitely kind of feel like I overbooked myself. But tomorrow I get in the truck and I go to Penland to teach a 2-week workshop there.
Wow.
And then right when that ends, you know, that ends on a Friday, and then the next Monday I come back here to teach my brand new workshop for aspiring educators called School is Cool. And that's a 4-week program. So that's a really new long-term program for us. And then I think I have 1 week without classes, and then it's the big 2-week collaborative sculpture workshop in the Octagon. So I'm just kind of like preparing for and making sure all those programs go off with it without a hitch at all at the same time.
So, yeah. So this is like back to back to back. And I know based on how classes are, there's so much prep in getting ready before the first day of classes.
Yeah.
I mean, are you have like, you got a cut list that you're giving to somebody and you're.
Yeah. Well, you know, Mark, my studio mate here, and he's the classroom manager. He's been, you know, really monumental in having all this stuff run without, you know, any problems or issues. And
have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of 5-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
And he definitely, he's really list-oriented and performs well when tasks are presented and organized. So we work together on that kind of stuff. And so, you know, when I go out tomorrow to Penland, he's got a list of like tools to make for the big collaborative sculpture workshop and steel to order and tasks to accomplish to help make sure that goes off without a hitch. And then I think ultimately it's up to me really to prepare for the School is Cool workshop, which I've been doing intermittently throughout the 6 weeks here. So I feel like I'm pretty well prepared, but you know, that's much more of a like philosophical kind of workshop. It's definitely hands on, but there's a lot of research you have to do and a lot of thinking and writing that you have to do about the thing you want to teach. So I've been kind of getting all that stuff together on the back end here, making sure I'm prepared for that aspect of the workshop during the Forging Focus. I was doing all that.
The School is Cool class, when you first talked about it, is so you're teaching people how to teach a class, and then everyone has the opportunity to teach a class to the class,
right?
And then there's a critique. This one to me felt the most like art school, where you do something as a group and then you have a round table critique. And everyone gets this kind of very focused group critique. And all I can think of is just like, boy, it sounds like art school to me.
Well, you know, we do that during the Forging Focus as well. And I think you should do that in any educational experience, really. But without feedback from your peers and instructors, I mean, how are you really going to grow?
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess it's pretty art school-y, you know, and I have... I have these things that I think about when I create a workshop that I can like relate to my students, that talk about, you know, what kind of skills are involved, what's the philosophy behind it, what are you learning? Like I have these lists, and And whenever I develop a project, I fill out these lists so that I can have it sort of clearly defined. And then when I present it to the students, you know, I can tell them why this is important, what we're expected to learn, how do you measure success, like all these things that you need in a real education. And I'm going to present these students with that kind of stuff and expect them to fill it out for, you know, one or more projects. And then we're going to sort of narrow it down to one that's successful. And then, you know, they'll have the time to research in the shop to make the thing so that they can create a lesson plan that fits within the time frame of the allotted workshop, and then, yeah, teach it and then get feedback.
Wow. That's the one thing about what you've done that's so amazing, is it's so focused and organized. And the, what you're also, you're focused, you're expecting the people who come to these to be as focused, and, you know, you're giving them not only the forging tools, but also the organizational tools to help them kind of succeed. You're giving them the tools to succeed, really.
Yeah, I hope so, man. But, you know, I don't know. It's, I do my best, but I sometimes, like, you know, I think about what we're doing here, and it's like, it's really fun and exciting, and rewarding, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I'm not reinventing anything. I'm just taking the basic foundational principles of good educational experience and then applying them to forging, which, you know, very few people are doing nowadays. There's some schools out there and some educators that are definitely doing it that I really respect, but in this growing world of popularity and people who are beginning to teach, it's really necessary. I think it's necessary more than ever. And that's why I said, like, and this conversation has come up a lot in regards to the 2-week collaborative sculpture workshop, because, you know, at CMA, and this should be, you know, if you've been following along with our conversation since I started chatting with you on these things, it's no secret that, like, I'm trying to create a formal educational institution and not just have these little independent craft experiences, but have educational programs that are rooted in, you know, appropriate ways to work the material that you can take with you to your career or however else you want to work the material.
One of the things I've been noticing in terms of just my business and talking to other people in various businesses is, like, there's something going on right now. And what we're noticing is we're having a lot more repeat business. I refer to it as we're feeding off of repeat business. We're being fed by repeat business. Are you finding that the people who are taking the courses at CMA keep coming back, or are you getting a lot of new people, or?
Well, you know, with CMA, our paid programming is a lot of returning students, which is the most amazing compliment ever. But our scholarship programs are all new students, really. I think there's some repeats for, you know, people that have been awarded a scholarship for the Forging Focus might also get a small scholarship for the residency sometimes, you know, but scholarship funding generally is new people every time. And that's the whole point of that program, is to make, you know, the programs that we're offering here accessible to the broadest possible audience. So you can't really give people, you know, whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know.
There's no repeat students in the scholarships, basically.
But, right, of course. I mean, it's,
but in the other ones, there are, and it's a big part of why we change our workshops every year. And, you know, like I said, it's a great compliment, because if people come here and they see the educational facility and they witness the instructors and the preparation and all that stuff, really touches them, I think. And then they go, oh my God, like, I want to come back and do this again. So it's a great compliment.
Tell me more. Are you getting ready for the Cambria Iron Festival? Cambria Iron Conference.
Yeah, dude. Last week I had my trusted confidants who helped me with the octagon work and stuff. We built new burners for the new furnace, and we put the roof on, and we plumbed propane over to it, and everything's really, you know, seems really successful. There's a couple more loose ends to do. Like, I got to build the doors and the opening and closing system, and then just kind of find the appropriate blower and then mount everything to the floor, and then we're off to the races.
How do you source the correct blowers, and how do you know what kind of plumbing you should be using? I'm asking a simple question. You probably have a very easy answer, but I don't know. I wouldn't even know where to begin.
I don't have an easy answer for that, but that's where, you know, this whole thing is like, whatever is happening at CMA, it's not just me, you know, it's like a community effort, right? So I have people who are, you know, involved in the Octagon work crew that know about plumbing and air and pressures and, you know, pipe sizes and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so I really lean on them for, you know, consulting and decision making and all that kind of stuff. And then when it comes to the burners, you know, my buddy from West Virginia built me the set of burners we've been using on the other forge. And what we did, we just took them apart and then rebuilt the same situation. So we sort of had a blueprint to follow. So that was kind of nice.
It's one of the things I kind of wanted to talk to you about is just changing topics for a hair. Is you sent me a pair of tongs not too long ago, and this past week, in the last 2 weeks, I've been doing a lot more forging. We've had some opportunities to do integral bolster knives, and we were doing some integral bolster knives. Maritime Knife Supply sent me some steel, and it was really, really, you know, really easy to work with. Mm-hmm. And I changed my approach, and I was thinking about you because the way I used to forge integral bolsters was I was forging the beginning stage to forge the tang, or like, I guess it would be like the tenon, and to make sure that I had a good fit for my tongs. And then I would start to make the incision and then forge the blade out, pull the heel down, all that stuff. And then I had this particular size steel that I was sent by Maritime Knife Supply, and I was just like, oh, this is a perfect opportunity to use the tongs that Pat sent me. You sent me some 1-inch tongs. And I held the bar was 1 inch, or maybe 1 1/8, and I started to forge, and I started to realize, boy, these are really comfortable. Like, the fit of the tongs to the fit of the material was so comfortable that I changed the approach of how I forged this, I changed the steps. Like, I no longer started off with the tenon, and what I started.
Right. Well, you wanted to hold the material as long as possible in that comfortable grip, right?
I wanted to hold the material as long as possible in the comfortable grip, number one. But I found myself, when I didn't start with the tenon, I was closer. My tongs were closer to where the forging part was going to be, where I was going to forge the blade out. And then I was just like, this is just too comfortable. I'm changing my approach. And then instead of doing the tenon first, I did the tenon last. And what I started to think about you, as I thought about you in terms of, like, because I had a very specific size piece of steel, and I was just like, boy, this is like the math class. This is the math class where I'm all of a sudden, I have enough material at the end where I'm not taking too much material off of the tenon. I'm not having to grind anything off. And I was like, these goddamn tongs made the whole experience better, but it changed my approach. And I started to think about how, but one of the most exciting things as growing in forging, when you're doing forging through your whole life, how these great moments of changing your approach can happen. There's so many, you know, there's a million ways to skin a cat. And in forging, there's all these like moments where you're just like, boy, if I just did it this way, or I changed my approach, or I had the right tools, do you find yourself in this position where the right tool changes your approach to what you're doing?
Well, every time. you know, in a perfect world, I have the right tool right off the bat, but the process always dictates the tool you need. And sometimes you don't always have the right tool, but when that moment is realized, I stop and then I make or source the right tool, because I don't, life is too short to be messing around with the wrong tools. And it's just not the way that one works if they take their craft seriously. So having the right tools is essential. I've been saying this, like, and it's the backbone of our educational curriculum. I don't teach anybody anything that involves material you can't hold in CMA tongs. It's just, that's not how you teach and that's not how you learn. So yes, I find myself in that situation all the time. But what's really important about that is realizing it, stopping, getting the tool you need or making the tool you need, and then starting over. Or starting from that step if you realize it, because if you don't have it, you're going to suffer through it. And then why spend the time and energy suffering through it, taking notes and recording the process that's not accurate because you don't have the right tool, to then make the right tool and then do it again and have it work out differently and disregard the notes and experiences you just took? Do you know what I mean?
This is one of the biggest things that we get here and we get over at Knife Talk, which is, I want to do this, but I don't have this tool. How do I do it without this particular tool?
That, I mean, might come be on. You don't do it or you suffer through it, but it's like you should just get the right tool to do the job.
Delayed gratitude is for suckers. It's like a degree of madness, because we get this all the time. I want to make this, but not only do I not have, it's usually like people want a power hammer or people want
press.
Oh
yeah, definitely.
And then
yeah,
they're just like, I want to do, you know, giant billets of Damascus, but I don't have a press. What should I do? Or I want to make this, but I don't have this. What should I do? And it's just like, we always say it sucks, but you're just going to be fighting for the rest. You're going to be fighting until you figure it out, and then you're going to kick yourself afterwards.
It's patience, you know what I mean? And it's discipline, and like all those things will help you make better work. And sometimes it's the hardest thing in the world to stop making something, to take a step back, to make a tool or a fixture. And I know that because it happens to me all the time. And you feel like the creative juices are flowing, your motivation is high, the forge is hot, you know, the material is hot, like I just got to try it, but it's not worth it, in my opinion.
So how do you think this new forge is going to change the way you guys work?
Well, the whole concept of this workshop and conferences, we're just doubling the forging capacity. And now that we have two hammers that run basically with the flick of a switch, we're able to have two teams of smiths working in there at the same time. And so we needed two furnaces. So now, you know, one furnace is kind of dedicated to one hammer and one team, and then the other furnace for the other hammer and the other team. So it's like my dream has always been multiple teams making sculpture at the same time on these industrial hammers. And, you know, the way the timeline has been working, I felt like this September was a good opportunity to realize that vision.
Have you ever had a time where you are very focused on a project you're going to do? You're all excited about it. You're working on it. And then you stop because you have to stop everything to make a tool to fix a problem.
Yes, all the time.
Can you kind of recount one of those times?
I don't know if I can specifically, but I know that it happens all the time. And then I have this like thing that I try to explain to my students, which is like, you know, I will spend 2 days fabricating a tool or a fixture or something for the fly press or a bending jig or something for the hydraulic press or a die for the power hammer or whatever for 40 seconds of forging. Do you know what I mean? But
yeah,
that's the idea, is like there, you know, there's a way to get it to happen efficiently you know, I always want to say like the right way, but there's a lot of different right ways, and I'm not that kind of person that's like, this is the right way.
Yeah.
But you know, there is definitely a wrong way. And oftentimes that's when I stop, is if I feel like it's the wrong way and there's a better way. And then I'll take the time to do it because, you know, I'm not interested in wasting time. And 2 days spent fabricating the right fixture to make a bend or forging or something is actually saving time. So,
yeah. Oh man, that's the best. I think about that all the time because especially these tongs, like now I've like kind of cleared the decks and now I've changed the way I'm forging this particular process. And it was not only was I more comfortable, but I was like more efficient and I was also more efficient with the material. Like yeah. It was without question, like a very mind. It was a mind opening situation, but it was one of those wonderful situations in forging, especially when you're doing it throughout your whole life where you have these, it's like a eureka moment. And I've had those a couple times, like when I first started doing the friction folders, I had a specific way I used to do them. And then there was a problem that I was having in terms of, it was opening and closing problem that it was an issue with the forging, and I just changed my approach and it was like this total eureka moment. And I have the progression boards of the mistaken one mm-hmm. and the one, and then the second evolution. And I always bring both of them because I explain how I came to this conclusion. And it's always like, yeah, I spent a lot of time doing it the wrong way, but once I figured out how to do it the right way, it made looking at the wrong way just kind of nice, you know?
Yeah. I mean, what you're describing is research in the material and a good educational example.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
You know, we got a lot of great questions.
Good. Great.
Do you think we should do a couple of them? Do some as many as we can?
I think we should.
Guys, if you want to ask Pat Quinn a question, here's a couple ways you can do it. You can go to Full Blast Podcast on Instagram, and then you can DM us your questions. Every so often, I'll put a little call to action, or you can send them to the Center for Metal Arts on Instagram, or you can send them to Hand Forged in VT on Instagram, and then we're gonna get you. And trust me, we talk about research. Pat goes through these questions and writes a whole. He's spent time on for you. So the first one comes from Paul Jansen. Paul Jansen said, "Here's a question for Pat Quinn: which is more important, where you hit or how hard you hit? Hitting the wrong spot can cause obvious problems, but not hitting with the appropriate force can cause problems too, whether too hard or not hard enough."
Great question.
I'll never not laugh at that. I'll literally never not laugh at that.
Yeah, it really is, of course. And it brings up, like they all do, like whole slew of things to talk about that are really important if you're interested in forging. But, you know, ultimately, where you hit and how hard you hit are both important, of course. And you know, a really experienced blacksmith can work within a range of both power and accuracy fluidly. You know, hopefully accuracy is always 100%, and then power is something that you can vary throughout a heat that you don't really have to bring a lot of mental attention to. It just becomes second nature. But I would say where you hit the material or what tool you're using to minimize or maximize the surface area or direct the material is much more important than how hard you hit it. A hard, inaccurate hit is a much bigger setback to your progress than a light, accurate hit, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So it's like, if you don't have accuracy, then you're not ready for power, like full stop, right? So what I always tell the students is, especially when we do, this translates really well for projects that need striking top tools or forging directly on the hot material with a striker, is you work on accuracy first, power second, because power is nothing without accuracy, but actually a setback. So I would say that accuracy is much more important, but it makes me feel like, you know, the one thing that is worth talking about that I can't stress enough is you don't have to focus so much on the power if you get your material hot enough. And that's, you know, not true for like every size material, but for the most part, what we're forging, you can, if your material is at an appropriate forging temperature, you don't really have to focus so much on the power, because another thing that's more important than power is heat. And I try to express that to students here as well, is get your material hot and then you don't have to swing as hard. So if you get your material hot, like really hot, and you have accuracy behind you, then power becomes much less important.
That's in the knife making game, that's one of the biggest issues. And a lot of it is like, if you're making it, forging a chef knife, which you did amazing, by the way, your progression boards of how you forge chef knives. The biggest issue that a lot of people have is especially that it's usually the end of the heel. And a lot of times people don't take into account how much material you have to take off when you're making a knife. If you try to squeeze out a little bit more length or a little bit more tip or a little bit more heel, and then they don't account for the fact that there's more material towards the spine, and maybe you should be moving the material higher up and then kind of pushing it down as opposed to just kind of focusing on the tip, and then you end up with like a lot of thinness. That's always been one of the big things. And then you can see it when people forge integral knives. And then once they grind it, you can see when they forge it, and you can see how much material they took off that they couldn't convert into a finished knife. Right. And that's one of the big things in the knife game. That's the hardest part, is the accuracy and then the kind of like thinking about where you're supposed to go.
Right.
Okay. This one comes from J.D. Eiler. J.D. Eiler he sent it from me on Instagram to Full Blast Podcast on Instagram. Here's a question for Pat Quinn. I see mostly farriers using the big block brushes to clean their work. In videos, it seems like a shower of scale coming off flying, leaving the piece clean. I haven't been able to quite get the same results. Pat mentioned he pickles all of his work to remove scale, but I'm curious if he has any advice for effective scale management during/after forging.
Great question. Ton of advice. this whole wire brushing phenomenon is really interesting to me, because I do have a lot of opinions on this, if you can believe it, but I generally feel like it's a waste of time to wire brush before you start forging. So this concept of taking your work out of the forge, brushing it, and then hammering it is inefficient, because you're brushing it during your most optimal time to forge. And why would you waste that heat wire brushing? The best way, 100%, to remove fire scale is to forge your material. So, you know, if you have a ton of scale on it because you're using a gas forge or whatever, if you start forging it, all that scale comes off. So don't, you know, I wouldn't waste time wire brushing at the beginning of a heat, because forging is a race against the clock. As soon as it comes out of the furnace, you're losing heat. And you want to work at the most optimum time, which is when the material is the hottest. So if you just start hammering it, you're doing the same thing your wire brush does, but you're also, you know, breaking down your material at the most optimum time that you're given, which is right when you come out of the forge. It might not look that cool on Instagram though, but it'll be better for your work. So, and then when it comes to like pickling it, I'm sorry, dude, am I going too fast?
No, dude, okay. You're good. You're good. I got a question in here, but keep going, right? Pickling.
All right. Well, I pickle to patina, right? So it's like the patination chemicals that I use to finish my work don't patinate over scale or oxidization. So That's the main reason why I pickle. There is, you know, some scale on the piece as a result from the process always. You can't, you know, you can't avoid it. If you hate fire scale more than I do, you should work with a non-ferrous material. But I pickle mostly for the patina, right? So it's like the work has a certain look to it if it's been scaled up and then pickled, versus if you work with scale management in mind and then pickle. And what that means is, like, what's more important to me than pickling for surface finish is finishing my work at a low heat, right? So if I don't want fire scale on my work, then when I'm done, I won't put it back in the forge, right? Because forging removes the fire scale. And then if you finish your work as it's cooling off and you don't get it back up to a temperature at which it develops fire scale, then you won't have a very scaled surface. So it's like, you know, when I'm forging out tong reins or a taper for a sculpture or whatever, you know, I finish that stuff at a dull red heat. And I do that for a reason, because surface quality is really important to me, the smoothness of the metal from the forging. So if you finish your taper and then at a dull heat and there's no fire scale on it, then you pickle that, you've got a beautiful surface that you can then patina. But if you finish your taper and then think, oh, okay, well, I need to take like one more heat on just the tip or something, and then you get the whole taper hot, and it scales up again, and then you take your one more heat, then you're going to have a surface that's been heavily scaled that you then pickle, the scale comes off, but there's still evidence that you didn't finish your work at a lower temperature, which is important for the surface. So I keep all that in mind when it comes to finishing and surface texture, which I really like to be smooth. And so I feel like, you know, if you're careful about how you forge and when you finish and the temperatures that you're working with, that's like the most important way to remove fire scale. And then it, you know, I got caught up in the whole wire brush thing several years ago, but have since learned that it's a waste of time most of the time. And the times I will use a wire brush right out of the forge are if I can't see my facets, or if I have a shallow shoulder, or if I have a center punch mark or a cold chisel mark that I need to hit with a tool. You know, those are appropriate times to brush the scale off right away. If it's a matter of not seeing a facet or something like that, then it's all good. But brushing for the sake of scale removal before you forge is a waste of time. You should just forge it, and the scale will fall off when you forge. And then if you know you're getting to your last heats of the shape, you do them at a lower heat, then your forging won't have any fire scale. Also, gas forges produce much more fire scale than coal forges. So if you're really concerned about surface, you know, coal forge is a much, much cleaner burning environment that produces much less fire scale.
So that's also the oxygen. The oxygen is what kind of really kind of helps with the more fire scale.
Right, totally.
What do you think the difference is, or I mean, I'm asking in terms of like, how would you rate or how would you differentiate the way like a wire wheel on a right angle grinder removes scale or to one of those block brushes? Because there is a difference.
Yeah, there is a major difference. A wire wheel on a bench grinder or a right angle grinder is incredibly aggressive, and it will actually abrade some of your material, and it'll soften sharp corners. And so you have to make decisions based on what kind of work you want to create, if that's the right tool for you or not. Oftentimes, I don't use it because it's annoying and it's too aggressive for me for finish work. And that's partially why I pickle as well. And that's partially why I don't sandblast. Like, I appreciate sandblasting and would love it someday if I was in a position to have a nice blast cabinet or blasting room or something like that. But that that stuff really abrades the surface and dulls the corners of a lot of things. And it can like muddy up subtle transitions and things that I really value about my work. And so I tend to stay away from them. And that's why for surface cleaning, I tend to use pickle or vinegar or, you know, some sort of etchant to get rid of the fire scale, because it doesn't really change the quality of the forging like a like an abrasive will. Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%. I've noticed the difference. I mean, yeah, 100%. A wire wheel, especially when the steel's hot, it just like it removes it almost completely. You ever use muriatic acid, or is that kind of not?
Yeah, I have. I used it more in Carbondale or whatever, and I appreciate the speed at which it removes fire scale, but the disposal of it and the kind of, you know, working with it is a lot more hazardous than vinegar. And so that's why ultimately I choose to have a lot of vinegar around, even though I hate vinegar. But it's like safer to work with, and you know, if you accidentally splash it, or it's not like muriatic. So, you know, I think muriatic is great for rapid scale removal, but it takes a lot more care and attention, and you know, disposal of it's a lot different and stuff like that. So
my favorite patinaing agent these days are varieties of mustard. I can't get it. The mustard patina is unbelievable. I learned that. Well, I know my friend Jared Thatcher, he was telling me, he's like, if you want to make a patina, use Grey Poupon. And then when I was in Spain, Tomer Bodner says to me, no, you got to use the cheap French's mustard. So then I use both, and you get the difference between the French's mustard. So you take a little sponge and you map it out, you mop it up, and then you let it kind of like give it 5 minutes and wipe it down. And then you do the Grey Poupon. You have this two different color gradation of patina. It's madness, and it's food safe. It's crazy. So some guys use one mustard. They don't talk about it. I'm using two different mustards, and I'm getting this really rich, two different scales of two different like it's like printmaking. It's layering of these two different gradations of patina. It's madness.
That's crazy. I'd have to give that a shot sometime.
Oh, dude, mustard. Unbelievable. Food. Mustard coffee. The whole thing is food safe. You don't have to worry about it. Some guy said to me, he's like, "What about A1 steak sauce? Can you use that?" I'm like, I'm tempted to try.
What about ketchup?
I think that
ketchup has vinegar in it. That says probably good.
It's the mustard thing is bananas, but it only works if you got to grind stuff away. You got to grind stuff away. You need that kind of clean steel to get the finish. But
always need that though. You can't finish anything that hasn't been scale removal. It just won't work.
You got to try it. It's hilarious. Like, I mean, the fact that you can go down to your like bodega, get some mustard, and then create this patina, this food safe patina, is hilarious. I'm a huge fan of that. Next question comes from Corey Eck. Corey Eck says, "Hey Jeff, I have a question for you and Pat. That's a great question. When drawing out some thicker material, thicker than 1/4 inch, what moves material quicker? A heavier or lighter hammer with a fatter or skinnier peen? Really appreciate what you guys are doing for my, and my favorite podcast episode to listen to every month is you and Pat." Corey X, a fan.
Yeah, what a nice comment. Can't thank that person enough.
Corey rules.
Thanks for the great question, buddy. Really appreciate it. It is a good one. Thicker than 1/4 inch, what moves the material quicker? A heavier or lighter hammer blow with a fatter or skinnier peen? Okay, there's a lot of different ways to dissect that. I think the ultimate takeaway from that is the quickest way to move material in anything is to minimize the surface area of which you're displacing. So the smaller and narrower your peen is, the quicker the material is going to move. And because you're pushing down less material per hammer blow, which means you're getting greater depth of penetration and more efficiency. So that's something that I consider and is a big part of my educational curriculum is being conscious of the surface area at which you're displacing and using that to your advantage to move the material either quicker or slower. So if you want to move the material quickly, minimize your surface area. If you want to move it slower, maximize it. And then within that concept or philosophy, you can select a hammer that is appropriate weight for what you're trying to do. And I would say I would always err on the side of having a lighter hammer and displace smaller surface area. And of course, have the right heat, but then have a heavier hammer and a bigger peen and have to swing harder.
That's one of the big questions we get a lot in regards to starting out and what kind of hammers we should be looking for. And that was something that I kind of wanted to bring up to you. I love that idea of the smaller surface area and kind of thinking about it. I notice when I have a couple of your hammers, the peen is much smaller than other people's, you know, the peens of other people's hammers. And I guess were you going to say, did I interrupt?
Or? No, no, no. I'm ready whenever you're ready. So keep going.
I was just going to say in terms of moving material, the difference between what you're looking for with a rounding hammer versus a cross peen. Can you kind of like differentiate the expectations of what you're going to get with those different types of hammers?
Sure. And hopefully this doesn't create a ripple in the hammer making community.
Don't worry about them. They're fragile enough. Don't worry about them.
Well, a hammer face that is equidistant in all directions, like square or round or something like that, is going to displace the material in all directions when you forge on it. So the difference between a flat face and a rounding hammer per se is a rounding hammer is just going to do it more aggressively because you've minimized the surface area which you're displacing when you strike it by finishing that hammer face round. And the more round you make it, like the more smaller diameter you do the sphere, the quicker you're going to displace the material, but it'll turn more into like a ball peen hammer if you go too aggressive with it. But those two hammer faces basically displace the material in all directions. And so a cross peen or a fuller really moves the material specifically perpendicular to the peen or the fuller. So that sort of shape should be selected when you're trying to like move the material in a specific direction. It's advantageous to not have it go in all directions, which for the kind of forging I like to do is most of the time. So I almost have no use for a rounding hammer unless I'm forging sort of the inside of a radius or something like that where the edges of my flat hammer face won't get without putting hammer marks in it. But that's sort of the basic principles behind those two hammers.
Has your approach changed in the kind of hammers that you've used over the years?
Yes, 100%. And when I taught hammer making to this group, it was really fun because I've got sort of like a retrospective of the hammers I've made throughout my career, and you can see the progression from this like overly forged, really cheeky, fat kind of like soft peen that's crowned in both directions to a much more sleek, streamlined, traditional style hammer with a flat face and a narrower peen that's not as soft. It has been told to me by people and someone that I really, really respect that traditionally the cross peen of the hammer should just be a narrow section of the forging face, right? So the modern trend is to make it like a big squishy fuller. But the traditional smiths that would work at the anvil to make a living, their peens were, if you just take a narrow slice or section of the forging face, that's kind of what your peen should be like. And that's that, because that moves the material super aggressively. And so I've sort of transitioned over to that idea. I do soften some of the edges a little bit more than I've seen some traditional hammers, but ultimately that's the philosophy that I'm subscribed to at the moment.
And like, did you used to be more of a rounding hammer guy, or did you was there a specific type of hammer that you used to use more and then you've changed, or?
No, I think I've always picked up a cross peen, you know, and I certainly have some rounding hammers, but to a certain degree, I don't use the peen or the round side of any of my hammers as much as I use the forging face, you know. But I think a cross peen is just much more versatile than a rounding hammer, and so that's kind of, you know, how I was raised and the hammer that I use. And then, you know, my hammer is really, I think, inspired by German style cross peen. And that has a lot to do with the shape of the head, but also the length of the handle. You know, I'm somewhere in the 14 inch long, maybe 16 if you include the height of the head. Sort of length there, but I'm at like 2 1/4, you know. And I made a hammer recently that was 2.5 pounds, and that's just way too heavy to swing every day. So there's this big hammer trend too, is kind of crazy to me, but to each his own. But I'd rather get the material hotter and use a lighter hammer, or have a little bit longer of a handle so I could choke down to get more velocity on my swing than use a heavier hammer. But, you know, I've injured myself before, so I don't take this subject matter lightly, because I don't want to damage my body. And, you know, so I'm really conscious of that. So this idea of picking up a 2.5 to 3.5 pound hammer to do general purpose forging, I think is not advantageous for a healthy lifestyle.
Yeah. One of my favorite things, I've said this to you before in the past, is I have one of your hammers that you made when you Center for Mental Arts in Florida, New York, and I have one of your hammers that you made in Johnstown. And what I love is, I totally believe that the your journey has influenced the work that you've done. I can see it in the tongs, but I love seeing the two different hammers together. Like, that to me is like, it's like this evolution of your philosophy.
Yeah, definitely. And it's no secret that I started making, you know, cheekless hammers after moving here. I mean, I've made a couple in New York and stuff like that, but all of my tool making inspiration and research is informed by the tools that I find here. And this place was, you know, 100% utilitarian. So all the hammers and top tools, there's no frills. It's just a tool that you forge, because forging is the right way to get the material into the shape you need. It's the most efficient and the best way to treat the material, to have a strong tool. So that's why they forge it. But there's no frills. It's just, you know, you punch the hole, you make it the right size and shape, and then you forge whatever business end you want off the end of the tool, whether it's a top tool or a hammer or something like that, and then you put it to work, you know.
Has this philosophy and this change in the no frills, have you noticed like a difference in, was there a data sheet in regards to the speed in which you make a hammer? I would imagine that because there are no frills, it may be you're making the hammer a little bit faster, and I would think that that's a degree of the, you know, the expectations of the efficiency of your technique.
Yeah, it's definitely faster, but it's taken time to get faster.
Of course.
Like developing the right size drift to follow the first drift, or if you're only using one drift, you know, what steps do you take to make the hole not long, like a hot dog and all that kind of stuff. But once you get there, you know, it is much faster. There's much less heats, like drawing those cheeks up and down and stuff like that, which is mainly the difference in time there. And I do all the drifting now on the power hammer, whereas I used to drift with a striker at a swage block and with a long drift so that I could hold it and then force your cheeks at the hammer. Yeah, it's definitely been streamlined a little bit, but you know, I toe the line between like taking my time and being efficient. Like I have no problem with taking time to make a nice clean forging. I do that all the time, but I want the steps in which I'm working to still be as efficient as possible.
Yeah, that's what I was getting. I mean, it wasn't, I was just imagining that cutting out the frills also kind of like changes your amount of heats and time.
It does. And then, you know, there's beauty and simplicity. And oftentimes, you know, simple forgings are much harder to make beautiful than complicated ones because there's not a bunch of stuff to distract your eye. But so I take, you know, I find appreciation in that when I'm digging through these old tools and stuff like that, that whole mentality of like, you know, forging because it's the right way to manipulate the material and then making something clean and simple and efficient so that you can use it to work is something that's really inspiring to me now.
Sweet.
Well, yeah. And you know, they didn't, you know, social media wasn't a thing back then. So they're not posting pictures of their hammers once they make them. They're just putting them right to use in the steel mill to help industrial forging, you know?
Were they, do you think, just out of curiosity, when they were making their own tools or they're making their own hammers, were they getting handles made and just putting them on, or were they, you think they were?
Yeah, they were. I have a bunch. Well, I don't have a bunch, but I've found some tools that do have handles on them, of course, and some actual just like new old stock handles, and they're made by a handle manufacturing company, but they have a property of Bethlehem Steel printed on them and embossed into the wood. Huh. And so they're really special to me. Like when I find them, I covet them and have them in sort of my industrial relics archive because they're pretty cool to find.
Do you think that the companies would contact these handle makers and say, we want a proprietary handle just for us? And then they would just send them with a very specific handle with the property of Bethlehem Steel on it, or?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, the handle looks pretty generic. Like I would say that depending on who's making the tool and what size drift they're doing, they're always expected to do some shaping of the top of the handle to get it to fit the eye. Like I've found huge tools with small holes and small tools with huge holes, and you know, every smith is different, and who knows over the course of 125 years in that shop, like who trained who and who likes whose tools better and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I feel like that the handles are pretty generic and always take some sort of modification to get to fit the tool that you forge properly. But at least you're not starting from raw stock. But I guess what I'm getting at is there was a certain point where I bet they made the handles in the carpenter shop at the steel mill, and then they provided them to the blacksmiths or whatever. But at a certain point after Bethlehem Steel took over the Cambria Iron and Steel Company, they went to a handle manufacturer, I think, not on site, that would make a proprietary handle for them.
Did that change the way you make your handles?
Oh, yes. You know, I've found some handles that aren't, you know, manufactured that are just beautiful and they're simple. And so, yes, it has changed the way I've made my handles. And when we did the hammer making section of the Forging Focus, I brought out all these examples of handles that I found inspiring that I encourage the students to kind of shoot for, which was functionality and simplicity. And I've taught hammer making enough to know that when it comes down to the handle making, for some reason, a lot of students want to make it fancy or have embellishments in it or too many curves or swells or facets or whatever. And so I've I've come to really try to stress simplicity and functionality. And I think a lot of these handles that I found have informed that sort of portion of that curriculum.
Hmm. All right, well, let's keep going. This one comes from Nomadic84. When can I buy a bridge anvil? Make it so.
Now.
Oh. Oh, you're taking orders?
I've taken 3 orders, yeah.
Holy mackerel. This is big news.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd think so, but I don't really publicize it. So, it's like I do want to make a certain amount of anvils every year that I can have for sale for sure. And so I've taken orders for 3 so far, of which I plan to forge this fall, and I'm really excited about it. But if you want one, you should just contact me and maybe we can work it out.
Wow. So are you planning on, in just out of curiosity, because I know when you were doing hammer runs or tong runs, you know, you'd have a specific amount in mind with forging an anvil, and I was grateful enough to be able to see, you know, the steps in which you're forging the anvil in the octagon. Do you have like a batch limit that you're prepared for? And then do you have to, like, because obviously you can't do it by yourself. You got to get all your guys and your team. Do you have tell me about how you're planning out this fall anvil.
Well, you know, I cannot imagine making more than 4.
Okay.
Just because I don't want to go full manufacturing anvil facility, right? Like, I think that's just not the vision here. The vision is to make anvils and do the necessary research to create a forged anvil. Mostly inspired by the bridge anvils here, but I'm sure I'll branch out into, you know, more standard patterns or stuff like that. But low batch, high quality always. So and like you said, it takes an incredible amount of coordination to get the team here to make anvils. So this particular year, and since I've made my first one and finished it, posted it, I've taken 3 orders, and I've always sort of had in the back of my mind that 4 would be the max, because I make 2 tops at a time, so it seems to kind of make sense.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm still going to make 4, but if I only have orders for 3, then I really would like the instructor anvil at CMA to be a forged. Well, I want to forge all the anvils for the classroom, but that's for a later date. But, I can see making the 4th one and putting it in the classroom for the instructor or something like that.
How exciting.
Yeah, you know, I've had a lot of inquiry about it. Of course, it's incredibly expensive, you know, so that turns people off right away. A lot of people, of course, but the people that have ordered them really... they kind of understand what we're trying to accomplish here. And I think they see it less like they're just buying an anvil and more like they're investing in CMA and our research and restoration.
That's the kind of people you want.
Exactly. Exactly.
Because you're not really commodifying what you're making anymore as much. I mean, it's not like... No one's going to say, hey, give me a 10% discount code. You know, it's just like when you're getting a forged hammer, a forged anvil, there's giant machines and equipment and experience and research and people physically doing it. There's no CNC. There's none of that stuff. It's like, I just can't even imagine. I do want to watch. But at the same time, yeah, I'm glad that the people are listen, you're going to sift through some, people. And I think that's better anyway. Right.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not for everybody,
yeah,
right?
Of course
but
not.
I do appreciate every inquiry. Honestly, I find I have a lot of great conversations with folks, and, you know, most of the people are really, you know, impressed and awestruck, and we have really nice conversations about what it's like to forge like big anvils again and all that kind of stuff. So ultimately I love the feedback, but you know, I've been pretty quiet about it too, in the sense that like I'm not advertising openly that I'm making anvils, certainly not, you know, for sale or anything like that. But the people that have reached out, that have ordered them, you know, like we mentioned earlier, it's like they're not, you know, concerned. They're not going to, you know, nickel and dime me over like $1,000 or $500 or something like that. It is what it is. And it is what it is like, it's like a price that's high for the market, but low for what it takes to actually make one. So right. I'm definitely not making money off of it, you know, using volunteer labor and getting donated stock and, you know, all that kind of stuff, just to kind of like, it's all just supports the research. And that's what these people who have ordered them, they get that. And most importantly, they're patient, because, you know, I can't just walk in there by myself and make an anvil and then ship it. It takes a whole slew of different people with different skill sets to make one of these into a reality, you know?
And you got to get them heat treated, and you got to get them this, and you got to get them milled. It's a giant ordeal.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, milling the leg to body connection is time consuming, and surfacing the top. And, you know, and I'm always thinking about ways to like, you know, expedite things. And it'd be really nice to work with a machinist at some point that can help me like make these connections a lot faster than you can on my machine tools and in my shop with my schedule. But for the, you know, for the first two or four or whatever, it's, you know, it's up to me to sort of flush out all the details and get everything right. And, you know, sort of create like a pattern, honestly, that you can go off in the future, so that maybe I can, you know, employ some help to get some of this other stuff done. Because, you know, I want to do the forging and that's it. Right. So, yeah. And it's like, I'm definitely not set up to heat treat material that size. So I have friends that help me do that, of course. And I barely set up to do the machining. I take a lot of pleasure in that because I really like learning about that process, but I'm slow at it. And I generally don't have the right cutting tools to do the job. So, you know, contrary to what we were talking about earlier, I suffer through a lot of this stuff, but it's all in the nature of research, so that I can get the right tools. And then that philosophy does apply. So that's kind of what it's all about at the moment.
That's the most exciting part, because I mean, this is like still the research, because the fact remains, it's so heavy. It's such a massive undertaking that it's not like you can just, this didn't work right, and then you chuck it into the dumpster. It doesn't really work like that. I mean, and that's the best part about this whole thing, and I'm very excited for you.
Yeah, and you know, there's no real like historical text written about the process. You know, I've read Anvils in America over a few times, and there's a lot of great knowledge and research that Richard Postman did in that book and stuff like that. But it's not like really informative when you're at the hammer, you know.
Right.
There's some images there that are kind of inspirational, and of course all the anvils are pretty inspirational, and I wish he was still around, because I'm sure he would love to see the historic anvils in this shop, and would appreciate the fact that we're forging anvils again in America. But you know, unfortunately he's passed, but really still kind of course excited about what we're doing here.
Yeah. That's the best part. I mean, the whole thing is exciting. And I just remember, it was a number of years ago. And I remember talking to Jesse Savage about what you're doing. And we were talking about pictures of the big hammers. And I'm like, he's going to start making anvils, isn't he? And Jesse turns to me and goes, yeah, I think so. And it was like, I just could tell. I could just tell. I said, he's going to be, and at some point, I don't know, I'm going to go into what I think is going to happen in the future. I don't want to even put a thing on it. But it was very clear that's what was going to happen. And the fact that I remember seeing the first forging of an anvil, I was just like, holy shit, he figured it out. And it's just like, and then seeing it by your station on that beautiful bridge anvil, those legs. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, you doing it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a dream come true, dude. And ever since I learned that anvils were forged, or you know, early American anvils and German and all that stuff, and I've wanted to forge one, but never had the capability. So of course, you know, stumbling on this shop and moving here, I had a really strong desire to try it and to do so. And so having done it is a really big milestone in my career, I feel like. And it was fun because, like, I, you know, of course, moving here, you're like, well, I think this is a shop that can really forge anvils, or has the equipment to forge anvils appropriately. And maybe someday, you know, we could give it a shot. And then you kind of get the team together over a couple of years. You do some restoration on the hammers. You learn how to drive them. You make a bunch of scrap with donated material, and you know, shapes start to materialize under the, you know, between the dies of those big hammers. You experiment with tooling and side sets and fullers, and you know, you make tapers round and square. And then you're just sitting in the shop one day looking at one of those bridge anvils, and then it just like dawns on you, like, oh, I've made all those shapes at this point. I think I can make one of those. And then you just try it, right? And so, you know, I made two, and one still sits in the shop forged because I don't like it very much, and one was worth finishing. But that's the research process right there.
I remember back in New York when you guys made a small kind of, I would say it was a London pattern anvil, where you actually made the waist, and it was in two parts.
Yeah, then, it's 11 pounds. I have it right here in my office.
I remember the difference, and all I could think of is, I still, when I, even talking about your hammers and talking about the anvils, is how the time and place in your life, and the time and the place in your life, and the history has informed the decisions that you make. And that's one of my favorite things, and I've said this a million times, but I'll say it again. I've been following you for a long time. And what I feel as though, we talk about how Instagram and social media sucks, and there are parts about it that are awful. You never get to follow the development of an artist, or follow the development of the path forward like you do with Instagram. And I feel like it's been like a real exciting to be able to see where you've gone, where you've come from, and where you're going. And it's like, that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, you know, and that is one of the benefits of Instagram and social media, is if you can kind of see it as like a photo journal of your work or your career, then it's a very useful tool, for sure. So, I mean, amongst other benefits, of course, but I do like that about it.
Pat, what's next? Tell me what's next. What's going on? You know, you're going to go to Penland. You're going to do the, let's talk about the Cambria Iron Cambria Iron Conference. What's going on?
It's all that, really. But, you know, at CMA, you know, the Cambria Iron Conference just represents such a big milestone in our development here that I can't help but to really place a lot of mental energy and focus on that. And there's a lot of firsts going on. We're attempting to achieve a large scale sculpture that's entirely forged in the octagon, and it's the first class that I think ever of its kind, which means, you know, it's teams of smiths working on industrial scale hammers to make creative work. And I don't mean like, you know, Nazel 4 and 3Bs. I mean like, you know, 4,000 and 3,000 pound utility hammers. So it's a big deal, and it's a big deal from like from my perspective, like, what does this mean about the future of forged sculpture, to I've got to make sure everybody's safe, to I got to make sure everybody's having fun. So there's a lot involved in making this thing run, that I don't take lightly, of course, but ultimately really excited about it. And, you know, just thinking like, God, this is amazing. I can't wait to participate in this experience with these folks, and everybody, I'm sure, has an open mind about what they're about to embark on, and we're all in it together and all that good stuff. So,
and there you can sign up to be at the Cambria Iron Conference, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a modest registration fee, which really just helps us put on the conference. But, you know, there'll be this year, if everything goes as planned, which I have no reason to believe it wouldn't, we're going to have both the hammers running at the same time, making parts for this big collaborative sculpture that I've designed. And then also there's going to be a forging competition happening in the classroom. It's a really fun creative challenge that will involve power hammers if necessary, but takes place in our classroom and the tooling that's available at CMA, and that's should be a really fun thing also for people to watch and be a part of. And of course, there's the juried exhibition, which is really strong this year, of forge work, creative and functional, from people from all over the world that have submitted and been accepted. So it's a good event, and it's basically just all day Saturday. The exhibition opens Friday night. There's camping available as well at the neighboring park. So really looking forward to it. It's a good networking event, good place for people to get together and celebrate this wonderful craft.
And the conference is going to be September 21st, 2024. And then the exhibition is
the 20th.
From Core to Surface. Guys, listen to me. This is fun. This is fun for me. Is this still fun for you, Pat?
Hell yeah, I love it.
Great. Go to Full Blast Podcast on Instagram. Send your questions to Pat. We're going to keep doing this once a month at least, and then we're going to answer your questions. I cannot thank you enough, Pat, for giving me your time. I know you're about to finish off the last day of the forging workshop and the forging focus, and I send my regards to everybody, and I hope that this is a bittersweet end of the course, and you're fired up for Pendleton. You're fired up for all this. Looks like you might need a nap maybe at some point, because I think you got a lot going on.
Yeah, maybe after September.
Okay. All right. Get ready, guys. In October, there's going to be a nap.
I'm going to have a nice, good old-fashioned sit-down.
I like it. What is this? Oh, okay. I'm with you. A sit-down. So, guys, I want you to go to the centerformetalarts.org and then look at all the workshops. Look at all the conferences. Look at all the dates. I know I have a friction folder workshop, weekend workshop. I think there's still slots available. Go check that out. Go check out everything they're doing. Support the Center for Metal Arts. Support Pat Quinn. Hand Forge and VT. Send your questions to him. Send your questions to wherever you want. Send your questions to Full Blast Podcast. And we'll see you next week, Pat. Thank you so much.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Jeff.
All right, guys. We'll see you next week.
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
O'Reilly.